I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist either.
Yo, we're climate scientists, and there's no denying this. Climate change is real. Who's a climate scientist? I'm a climate scientist. Not a Clio finalist, no, a climate scientist. Dropping facts all over this wax. While fitness be crying about a carbon tax. Climate change is caused by people. Earth unlike alien has no sequel. We gotta move fast or we'll be forsaken.
Cause we were too busy sucking things in Copenhagen.
Hey, it's hot in here. 32% more carbon in the atmosphere. Oh-ee, oh-ee, oh-ee.
Change on crack, permafrost subtracts. Free back. Methane release is whack. Free back. Write a letter, then burn it. Free back.
Deny, let's deny this in your dreams. Cause climate change means greater extremes. Heat won't be the norm, heat waves bigger, badder storms.
The greenhouse effect is just a theory, sucker.
Yes, so is gravity. Float away, motherfucker! Climate scientist, I'm a climate scientist. A penny farthing cyclist, no, a climate scientist. A Fox News journalist,
no.
A paleontologist,
no.
A clean coal lobbyist,
no.
A cashed up alarmist,
no.
A climate study scientist, yo. Preach.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is The Myth of the Good Wars with Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn is a radical American historian, political scientist, social critic, activist, and playwright. Howard is best known as the author of the bestseller, A People's History of the United States. Howard has been active in movements for civil rights, civil liberties, and the anti-war movements in the United States. During World War II, Zinn was a bombardier in the 490th Bombardment Group. Howard's targets included Berlin, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary, as well as Royan, a seaside resort in southwestern France on which he dropped napalm.
I think my talk is advertised as the myth of the good war. Oh, okay. So maybe that's what I'll talk about. Sometimes you obey instructions. Okay. Well, actually, I had another title for this talk, which is roughly similar, and that is Three Holy Wars. Now, of course, when you hear Holy Wars, you're not really sure what is meant. Are they religious wars? No. By Three Holy Wars, I mean that there are three wars in American history which are untouchable, uncriticizable, right? Three wars that each mustn't say anything about those three wars to bring any question at all about them that may doubt their goodness, you know. And when I tell you what these are, you'll recognize immediately. I mean, you ever hear anybody say anything bad about the Revolutionary War? No. The British, maybe. but really, especially here in Boston, Massachusetts, and Pride and all the Liberty Bells and Sons of Liberty in Concord and Lexington and Bunker Hill, right? Oh, no, the Revolutionary War. What's that? Is there a voice in the crowd? Speakers are very sensitive to voices in the crowd. Especially when you don't know what they're saying. They might be criticizing you, like you're criticizing war. But no, nobody criticized the Revolutionary War. It's very obvious. It's a war for independence against England, right? A war which the United States was formed, created. You don't fool with that. Civil War? Oh, war to end slavery, huh? You for slavery. How can you say anything critical about the Civil War? And we have all these, you know, movies, glory, and, you know, and all black soldiers are enlisted and blacks fight in the Civil War. And, of course, there's Lincoln and, you know, all that hoopla. So pardon me for using a word like that, because the word hoopla suggests something not quite praiseworthy, hoopla, about the Civil War. And then, of course, there's World War II, the holiest war of all, really, a good war. And those of you who read Studs Terkel's oral history, which I recommend to you, you know, Studs Terkel wrote all these oral histories, and one of them was called The Good War, about World War II. We interviewed all these people who had been involved in World War II, people in the military, people who were civilians, all sorts of people who were in one way or another connected with World War II, called it The Good War. However, his wife suggested to him that he put quotation marks around good war. Good war in quotation marks. What does that suggest? Oh, maybe there's some doubt about whether it is completely, purely a good war. And in fact, as his wife had read all the testimonies about World War II, and after reading all the testimonies, oh, she wondered, should we simply call it a good war and let it go at that? No. Quotation marks around the good war. And yes, World War II, sacrosanct. And we know how the culture glorifies World War II, really. You know, the greatest generation, and all these movies about D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge and Iwo Jima and... Well, you know, the heroism, the military heroism, how we love military heroism. We don't have much about anti-military heroism. There's a lot of anti-military heroism. But no, it's military heroism. That's what kids who grow up on. That's what we teach kids. We teach kids about our military heroes. We don't teach them about our anti-military heroes. So it's no wonder that kids are vulnerable to military recruiters. Wow, they can become part of another greatest generation. But, so I am a troublemaker. I insist on taking a critical look at these three holy wars. Not to denounce them, not to simply push them aside, not to change them from good to bad, and, you know, as simple as that, let it, no. But I want to introduce some complicating and troubling questions into this whole notion of the good war, the holy war. Just want us to think about that, because we don't think about that. These are wars that are unquestioned. When something is unquestioned, it means you don't think about it. You don't ask questions about it. But I want to ask questions about it. I'm not saying I have all the answers about it, but I think we have to start thinking about it for a good reason, not for historical reasons, not for what some people think is the reason for doing history, to learn what really happened in the past so you can have an accurate picture of what happened in the past. That's not my intent. The past is past. No, the important thing about the past, and this has, you know, been my life's work as a historian, the important thing about the past, the important thing about history, is what does it tell us about today, and what does it tell us about tomorrow, and what does it tell us about what we might do in the world.
Here are great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Missiles flying in the third world towards the people stranded on their knees. Bombs falling over Baghdad, killing children who are starving by degrees. where those of us who'd question what's the goal and what's the cost. 600,000 dead malnourished children, a UN-sanctioned Holocaust. Missiles flying in the third world, from Hanoi to Wounded Knee. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and each one shouts, democracy. Contras, kings and generals, brandish stars and stripes. From Rangoon to Los Angeles, selling oil, guns and crack pipes. Missiles flying in the third world, and each one will kill a child. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and hunger and death is running wild. We had to destroy the village in order to save it, to help this jungle crawl. First we had to pave it. Fits and starts are everywhere. From the mountains of Chiapas to the streets of Central Square, empires fall. This one will too. So here's to the day when this one is through.
Now, back to Howard Zinn and the Myth of the Good Wars.
So the reason for examining these holy wars is not a historical, scholarly, academic reason. No, the reason has to do with now. It has to do with tomorrow. It has to do with how prone will we be, and how prone will our children and grandchildren be to accept the idea of war as possibly good. Because once you have a history of good wars, right? Once you have wars to point to that are noble, fought for good causes, once you have that in your history, well, you have something to point to. You have a model. Yes, you see, it's possible to have good wars. And maybe this is one of them. How many times has World War II been pointed to as an analogy with the ugly wars that followed World War II? The wars that everybody, pretty much everybody, acknowledges are not good wars, you know? Well, Korea, people don't know much about that. But Vietnam, certainly, no. Iraq, no. People do not think those are good wars, Vietnam, Iraq. But have you noticed how these acknowledged bad wars are justified by pointing to the good war? No, we mustn't appease Saddam Hussein, right? All the images of World War II come into being. Churchill, Lyndon Johnson called Diem, the leader of South Vietnam, the puppet leader of South Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson called him the Winston Churchill of Asia. we mustn't give in to Iraq because, or Iran, or any of these miserable countries. What right do they have to stand up to us? You know, no, we mustn't, because that would be appeasement. And appeasement is a word that goes back to World War II, right? Appeasement, Chamberlain, appeasement, Munich. Those words come back to presumably justify the wars that we engage in since World War II. So I'm saying that there is a reason for questioning the goodness of these wars, because if there are serious questions to be raised about the goodness of these wars, then you are undermining that certainty about wars being good, that certainty of the possibility of good wars. You're undermining these analogies that people use, you know, when they think, oh, you know, this is like World War II. Ho Chi Minh is another Hitler. Saddam Hussein is another Hitler. There's a present reason for going into the past. There's a present reason, future reason, for looking at these historic events and re-examining them. So, I'll say something about each of these wars. Come to think of it, I should keep note of the time, because I could spend a few hours on each war, and you would get thirsty. And I would get thirsty. Yeah. So I'll pretend to look at my watch from time to time and to care. Oh, okay. One of the things that's done in accepting a war like the Revolutionary War, and it's true also of other wars, that you generally only look at one side of the balance sheet. And by the balance sheet, I mean you draw up a list on both sides of the balance sheet. These are the good things that came out of the war. And then on the other side of the balance sheet is the cost of the war. What I'm saying is that the cost of the war is usually glossed over, because the goodness of the war overshadows everything else. If there's a good outcome, if it's done for a good cause, well, whatever the cost was, we're not going to look at it too closely. It was worth it. Now, wait a while. I don't think so. I don't think you can ignore the other side of the balance sheet. I don't think you can ignore the cost of the war. I insisted, even though you have some good things on the good side of the balance sheet. Yes, yeah, we won independence from England. That's on the positive side of the balance sheet. But I insist that you don't simply leave it at that, that you look at the cost of the war. Well, let's just take the cost in human life. Any of you know how many soldiers died in the Revolutionary War? I would guess that not too many people know, because it's never talked about. And because people assume it's an insignificant number, right? Yeah, you know, there was the Battle of Bunker Hill. There was Valley Forge. There was the Battle of Saturday. But, you know, it's no big deal. There's no point paying attention to that. We won the war. We got independence from England. 25,000 casualties. There may have been 50,000, but you probably know by now that casualty figures in war are very crude. Nobody really knows. There'll be disagreements up to 1 million. I'm serious. People, how many people died in Vietnam? Oh, I think 2 million. Or maybe 3 million. We're not sure. Really? Imagine not being sure. 1 million people just being, well, so, yeah, people don't know. 25,000, well, 25,000 is not much, right? 25,000, what's 25,000 lives if you win independence against England? 25,000 is less than half of the number of men who were soldiers who were killed in Vietnam. But wait a while. What was our population then? It was about 3 million. If you extrapolate, what would 25,000 dead mean in relation to the present population? Be 2.5 million. 2.5 million dead. So that if you want to say we are winning independence against England today, right? Let's pretend that today we've been subservient to England and we want to win independence, instead of, as is true, England is subservient to us and wants to win independence, you see. Would you be willing to sacrifice 2.5 million? Would you accept that 2.5 million people as a cost for gaining independence? Might you not say, well, hey, we do want independence, but is there another way? Another way we can do this without fighting a war that costs the lives of 2.5 million people? So on that side of the ledger, you have to put the human cost of war in every one of these good wars, and only then, and acknowledging the good side, but then at least you have an honest balance sheet, not a distorted balance, not a one-sided balance sheet, an honest balance sheet, and then you can make a judgment. If you decide, oh, yeah, it would be worth 2.5 million to win independence from it, okay, you can make that judgment if you want. Especially if none of those 2.5 million are related to you. But what about other factors? There's another thing that is generally, another question is generally not asked about good wars. Good wars are generally based on a single criterion of something good that was won. And there are other things, peripheral issues, other issues, side issues, or they seem like side issues, that usually aren't examined. By that I mean is, okay, the colonists win independence from England. Who gains? That's an interesting question. Who gains from victory in a war? Now, governments that fight wars, because it's governments that initiate wars and governments that fight wars, governments would like us to believe that all of us gain from a war. And that's not necessarily true. There are people who gain, and there are other people who don't gain. Did black slaves gain from the Revolutionary War? Slavery before the war, slavery after the war. Did the new government ushered in by the Constitution do away with slavery? No, it legitimized slavery. In fact, it declared slaves as 3/5 of a person. Diminished the humanness of slaves. In fact, blacks did not rush. You would think if the Revolutionary War had anything to do with not just winning independence from England, but winning liberation for black people, they would have rushed to the colors, fought for their own. No, they didn't rush at all. Washington did not want blacks in the Revolutionary Army. The English recruited blacks into the Revolution, because to recruit them into it would have meant promising them freedom. No, this government, the Washington, Madison, Jefferson, all slave owners, they were not going to promise freedom. The British were willing to, and they did. And only after the British began to enlist blacks, only then did the Continental Army begin to slowly enlist blacks.
Saddam, before you go, I want you to know this whole thing between you and me, it wasn't just between you and me. It's between you and me and my daddy, because you tried to hurt my daddy back in the day, and I don't cotton to that sort of behavior. So my daddy's here tonight, and so's my mommy, and I'm going to put you on speakerphone. Hi, Dad. How's it going, Dad?
Hey, son. Good to see you. You know, son, just like when I was president, war in Iraq, good. Economy, bad. I think I'll call you Mini-Me.
That's right, Georgie. And now there's all these stories going around about how you misused information from the CIA to justify going to Iraq. They said something about you were lacking the proper intelligence.
Well, look, Saddam, the good news is we have control of Iraq.
And the bad news is you have control of Iraq.
Some were saying, where is Saddam?
Now they're saying, where are the bombs?
Found you at last, down in your trench.
Surrendered fast, so you'd think I was French. A man who's bright would not start this fight.
But someone dumber might.
Wella, wella, wella. George.
Tell me, George.
He had weapons of death.
Tell me more, tell me more.
Just my spider whole breath. I was hiding, lived like a mole.
Then like a groundhog, you popped out of your hole.
Saw your shadow, you know what they'd say.
4 more years, a bush on the way.
A man with tact won't stay in Iraq.
But someone dumber might.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Tell me more, tell me more.
Why did you lose the war?
Tell me more, tell me more.
Got endorsed by Al Gore.
The case for war, it was so strong.
The case for war turned out so wrong. You made it up, you lied the whole time.
He just stole John Kerry's line.
No one sane will back your campaign.
But someone dumber
might. In a war.
And now for something completely different.